Major funding for Soundings comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities. It's Soundings from the National Humanities Center, conversations and commentary featuring scholars and visitors at the center. This is Wayne Pond. The National Humanities Center is an independent, nonprofit institute that encourages excellence in scholarship and affirms the importance of the humanities in American life.
I guess it is implying that these countries have to find a new identity, and a new identity does not just mean to find a political and an economic identity. Mm-hmm. It means, of course, to find a cultural identity as well.
Well, when I look at Greek history, of course, I'm always struck by analogies to present situations. It's a hobby of mine. When you start working with them, it seems to me you have to be very, very cautious indeed.
Welcome to Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Our topic this week is political change and cultural consequence in Eastern Europe. You'll hear first from Wolf Lepenies, director of the Institute for Advanced Study in Berlin. After that, Robert Connor, director of the National Humanities Center, will discuss American intellectuals and their response to recent events in Eastern Europe. During his visit to the center, Wolf Lepenies talked about political change in contemporary Eastern Europe. According to Wolf Lepenies, many European cultural commentators were unprepared for the rapidity and the nature of those changes. Wolf Lepenies calls this the failure of the interpretive class. First of all, talk to me about some of these political and cultural shifts that have been occurring recently. You say that you find them embarrassing and exciting at the same time. Why is that?
Well, I think exciting is fairly obvious because no one, and literally no one, could foresee that we would live through an age in which the old East-West division would disappear, as it seems to be the case now. So this is exciting, and I think we should rejoice just at this phenomenon. On the other hand, we have to bear in mind, and actually we see in Europe, that quite a lot of things which had been suppressed by the communist regimes are coming back, and the regimes suppressed bad things as well as good things. And among the bad things are nationalism, anti-Semitism. You didn't realize much of that in these countries in the past 40 years, not because they were not there, uh-huh. were just not allowed to pop up.
What does that imply culturally for what's going on in Europe now?
I guess it is implying that these countries have to find a new identity, and a new identity does not just mean to find a political and an economic identity. Mm-hmm. It means, of course, to find a cultural identity as well. They were denied this cultural identity because there was just a sort of the political ideological identity of the East Bloc, and they were allowed to be part of that. But they weren't even allowed for a long, long time to have, let's say, something like a Hungarian or a Czech or a Slovak socialism. Mm-hmm. Now, all of a sudden, they have the feeling that they can get back a sort of national identity, and this is an identity in economic and political and in cultural terms. Perhaps I could just give you an example. I'm traveling quite a lot in East Europe, and I've been to practically all countries in East Europe except Bulgaria and Romania. And what you find, for instance, is that people will ask you, whom have you seen so far? Whom have you met? And you tell them, and all of a sudden they will say, well, you should be a little bit more cautious. And you say, well, why? And they point to a number of list of names they have made of people you have seen, and they say, but they are all Jewish. Hmm. And you say, well, that doesn't mean a thing to me. I mean, I don't care if they are Jewish or not. They're just people I'm interested in. And they say, well, but you should see others as well. So you see, this is a context which has more or less disappeared from our own intellectual discourse.
What does it take to learn the lesson?
Well, you look, when I'm talking about anti-Semitism, I'm of course not only talking about intellectuals. We should keep that in mind, and maybe and hopefully anti-Semitism is a less widespread phenomenon among intellectuals than among others. I'm not sure. Let's hope that this is the case. I'm sure that this will disappear in the long run, or I hope it will disappear, But it is, you see, one of these things, as I said, which have been suppressed, which mm-hmm. have not been, so to speak, worked out. They have been suppressed, so it comes back again, and maybe it is almost natural, in quotation marks, that we mm-hmm. will have a, hopefully, relatively short period where that plays a role again, but then I hope it will fade away.
Well, what can the intellectuals, the artists, the playwrights, the painters, the poets, what can they do to work us through? Unfortunately, you say that we're going to have to work it through. We simply don't amputate it from the body politic. What do the intellectuals do to move us in that direction?
Well, I think we will have a sort of internationalization of culture in these countries as mm-hmm. we have it in other parts of the world. I must say I'm no longer thinking of myself as a German intellectual. I regard myself as a European intellectual. Mm-hmm. And a lot of things we do, quite naturally, we do together with French, with British, with people from the Netherlands and so on. And I guess this internationalization helps a lot. But we didn't have this sort of internationalization in the East Bloc. And when this will become stronger and stronger, as it inevitably will, mm-hmm. I think then we will have a chance to get rid of these phenomena.
The larger European picture.
Yes, in the larger European picture, you have on the one hand really the sort of re-emergence of the intellectual in the East. You have mm-hmm. all these people like Václav Havel in Czechoslovakia, like Arpad Gönc in Budapest. Like
who would have thought that we'd have a playwright running a country?
Exactly. I mean, he's running it quite well. That is the other part of the story. He's not just running it, he's running it well, I think, mm-hmm. With a marvelous feeling for political power as well. And so we have in the East the intellectual who has become the philosopher king, who has a utopia come true. But of course that is not the case in the Western parts of Europe. So what I predict and what I can already see happen now is a clash between two cultures, between the culture of the expert on the one hand in the West and the culture of the moralist in the East.
Will the Europeans learn anything from the Americans or is it going to be the other way around when you talk about a conflict such as that?
Well, I think the sort of integration you've had in the United States certainly could serve as a model, though I think you cannot just use that and give it as a sort of advice to people in Europe.
What I was thinking of is that we look back to the so-called founders of the American Republic. I guess that's as close as we've ever come to having philosopher kings, and that was 200 years ago.
okay, well, I was not aware you were talking about this phenomenon. Yes, of course. I mean, I have spent some time at the University of Virginia right now, too, and it was very moving to see how the Hungarian president who just visited, I've seen him there, Arpad Gönc, was referring, and quite naturally so, to this early American context uh-huh. as a sort of blueprint for what is going on in his own country, hopefully.
Uh-huh. You talked about the victory of culture over power as the basis for the success of the recent revolutions in Eastern Europe. What do you have in mind there?
Well, I should perhaps qualify that a little bit. It is more or less this notion, this word is a quotation from an article by Amos Ilon in the New Yorker, and he's especially referring to the Czechoslovakian case. Uh-huh. And in Czechoslovakia, we can really see that the opposition, the intellectual opposition, but the political opposition as well, was an opposition of artists, writers, playwrights, jazz musicians, and so on and so forth. And they were really able to turn the whole political structure around.
Should we call them heroes?
Yes, I call them heroes, and very deliberately so. I'm going back to Thomas Carlyle, and Carlyle, of course, saw the man of letters as the modern hero, and mm-hmm. I think this has won an actual importance one would never have thought about by reading Carlyle.
Well, but let me be a little impertinent with you. Isn't that arrogant to think that the intellectuals are going to take upon themselves or hope that the people will elevate them to this position of not only cultural leadership, but mm-hmm. political leadership? What, for instance, does aesthetics, one of the main concerns of the intellectuals, what does that have to do with political morality?
Well, I think it has a lot to do with it. If you look at the example of Václav Havel, Václav Havel, I think, has not been elected to high political office because of his political experience. He has been elected to high political office because he was a good artist and because he was sincere. So I think the combination of sincerity and artistic probity or just quality is one of the reasons why he was accepted by really a large, large portion of the constituency.
Let's turn our conversation to what used to be the two Germanys, what is now one Germany. Can Germany be one people as we move into the 1990s, into a new century? We look back on some of the unhappinesses of over the last 50, 60 years. What about that?
Well, you see, in a certain sense, I think Germany always remained one people. Though I'm not one who was talking about sort of the common German culture. I think the cultures have developed in quite different directions. But I think there were still close relationships between people in the two Germanies.
What about the intellectual currents between what used to be the two Germanies? You told me over supper, for instance, that give me this story, that it was easier to get an East German intellectual into the United States than it was to invite an East German intellectual into your institute in West Berlin.
Well, you would have to distinguish between, let's say, a country like the United States, between West Germany, between West Berlin, uh-huh, and East Germany. And
so
the most difficult place...
Had three Germanies.
Yes. The easiest for them, yes. Right. The easiest thing would have been to invite him to the United States. Would have been more difficult, but still relatively easy, to invite him to West Germany. Hmm. It was almost impossible to invite him to West Berlin. When we were able to do that 3 years ago, it was, I think, the biggest achievement we ever had in our institution in political terms.
Uh-huh. What do you mean when you use a phrase like the burden of the present? We're talking about the responsibility, I take it, of intellectuals in Europe to the revolutions that have been taking place there.
Well, I'm referring to something very general. That means we don't have an awful lot of time today. And intellectuals, as a rule, need time to mm-hmm. think about something and to address problems which are not short-range problems.
That's why we accuse them of living in ivory towers. Shouldn't we ask them to do that?
No, actually, when I'm looking around at European, and forgive me to say that, American politics, I must say I wish there was more of an ivory tower and there were more people who were looking a little bit more far ahead. Mm-hmm. I think there's a sort of short-range vision in politics, which is very dangerous. So I am here in favor of the ivory tower if it means that you look farther ahead. The burden of the present means we are so overwhelmed by the problems we have today and at this moment that we do not have enough time to look forward and to develop a sort of long-range visions of what should happen in the future. I think it is absolutely necessary that we conserve this function for the intellectual, and I think a place like the one in which we are talking right now uh-huh. is a place where one does exactly that, and one has to preserve that, and one has to make sure that the chances are better to develop this sort of long-range vision. Yeah.
Let's talk about teaching, research, education. What kind of marks would you give American education with respect to the way we train our undergraduates? What kind of marks would you give German youngsters in terms of their undergraduate education? Are the professors doing what they're paid to do?
Well, you see, it's very difficult, I think, because how could you compare, let's say, the University of North Carolina and Princeton and the University of Texas, places I've been in, with some smaller colleges or universities whose names I will not disclose. Mm-hmm. The differences are enormous. I think there's one big advantage in the American system, and I would very much like my children to have had, I must say, this opportunity. That is the college system. I think it's wonderful to have this beginning of an academic career where you are relatively still free to do a lot of things and not being forced to do just one thing.
Well, the critics of American education have told us that smorgasbord approach has been one of the downfalls of American education. You don't have that in Europe. Isn't that a strength?
No, frankly, I think what is interesting today is that the Europeans are going in the other direction. And we are very seriously in Germany thinking about setting up a scheme where students who enter the university would be more free, maybe not in the first 4 years, but in the first 2 years, in doing what they like and look around a little bit more before they go and have a rather specialized education.
Mm-hmm. Wolf Lepenies directs the Institute for Advanced Study in Berlin. You're listening to Soundings from the National Humanities Center. This is Wayne Pond. During a recent visit to the center, Wolf Lepenies discussed politics and cultural change in contemporary Eastern Europe. Soundings on political change and cultural transformation continues. You'll hear next from Robert Connor, director of the National Humanities Center. Robert Connor's essay about political change in contemporary Eastern Europe appears in the spring 1991 issue of The American Scholar. The essay is entitled, Why Were We Surprised? In it, Robert Connor discusses the question of historical analogy, with an eye to the parallels between modern societies and the military culture of ancient Greece. What I want to do is begin with this. A single day in July of 371 BC, Greek history changes. What does that have to do with the making of modern foreign policy and interpretation of cultures?
Well, let me tell you about the day first, Wayne. It must have been one of those hot summer days in Greece, and they were about to undergo one of the periodical battles that are so characteristic of classical Greek history. This time, lined up on one side, Sparta with a tremendous military force, maybe outnumbering almost 2-1 their opponents from Thebes on the other side, and a plain not terribly far from the hometown of those Theban troops. I think the Spartans had every good reason at that point to feel fairly confident that they were going to be successful against the Thebans. They were coming out with a powerful force, with a strong propaganda line of liberating the local cities. But by the time the day was over, the Thebans had won a remarkable and surprising victory.
All right, now there must have been people trying to figure out who was going to win that or second-guess the circumstances, much as we look today to these enormous cultural, social, economic shifts. They were wrong. Why?
Well, that's a tremendous question. I think on one side, the focus on, in this case, really purely military considerations, was a pernicious one. If you just counted the numbers, the Spartans should have won. If you counted their military reputation, nobody was going to stand up effectively to well-disciplined, crack Spartan troops. But when you look below the surface, you discover that that moment in Greek history, 371 BC, the Battle of Leuctra, is actually the culmination of a long slide in Spartan power that had been taking place under the surface for a long while, an economic slide, a social slide, ideological slide. So the surface looked pretty powerful, and right below it, I think, there were very serious weaknesses.
All right, now, if we want to talk about historical analogies, which is essentially what you have been outlining here, Bob Connor, give me the upside and the downside, the perils and the rewards, as we look back at history and try to figure out how to play our cards today, culturally, militarily, sure. All of that.
Well, when I look at Greek history, of course, I'm always struck by analogies to present situations. It's a hobby of mine. You find them there, and sometimes they're very striking indeed. When you start working with them, it seems to me you have to be very, very cautious indeed. When I looked at this one, there's some obvious and I think maybe some important parallels to the way in which the military reputation of the Soviet Union crumbled, for example, in 89 and 90, when we no longer think of it as a formidable military force outside its own borders. The analogy to Sparta, I think, comes along as quite a powerful one there. But when you look at it more closely, oftentimes there are the local specific situations. Mm-hmm. And I guess what really got me interested in this episode was that the failure we had to predict the changes in the Soviet Union, the changes in its military situation, its relationships with its allies, that part of the analogy strikes me as being quite powerful to what happened with the inability of the Greeks to predict anything like the dramatic change that took place there at the time of the Battle of Leuctra.
All right, now we want to avoid some assumptions and we want to embrace some other assumptions when we try to figure out looking back at history and looking at our own present day circumstances. Simply because we know about a number of factors in the Soviet Union, the military, the economic, principally, what you're telling me is that that really doesn't prepare us to understand the cultural undergirding dimensions that are prompting changes for which we're apparently unprepared.
Well, I think that's right. And I think one of the utilities of historical analogy is not prediction. I don't think it lets you say, hey, we've got two parallel situations here, and so let's just extrapolate, and we'll know what's going to happen to the Soviet Union because we were able to find an analogous system somewhere in the past of history. I think, rather, its value is heuristic. That is, when you look at one of these situations, sometimes you see factors, you see aspects of it that you might overlook in the contemporary one if you weren't looking at the historical analogy. They are eye-openers, in other words. And in this particular case, what struck me was that the scale of operation was much greater than anyone might have anticipated. That is, the changes that had been taking place in Sparta were not ones that were going on for a year or two before that. You could trace them back certainly a generation. And the consequences of the disintegration of Spartan power that followed on that July afternoon were still being worked out, I think, in a very, very serious sense, a century later in the Greek world.
All right. Now, if we can't expect from our, the combination of our professors and our politicians, an absolute sense of prophecy as we look to the future, what should we look for as the professors train the next generation of politicians?
I think that's a very important question, and I think it's one that we really need to focus in on. I think we've kidded ourselves by thinking oftentimes that with a proper educational system, with the money we've poured into think tanks and into very elaborate computer simulations and sometimes other forms of modeling, we really could produce a generation of experts that could sit at the politicians' elbows, or indeed be the politicians themselves maybe, and just say, hey, this is the way the world's going to go. It is, after all, a rational, predictable system.
Yeah, but you're overlooking all of that wonderful uncertainty that lurks out there.
And it's scary, of course. I understand why people want to overlook that uncertainty, because it's scary to live in a world where you feel you can't make real predictions. But I think that's the kind of system that we're in at the moment, one of radical indeterminacy, and hence that we really need to shift our educational patterns, that we have to take indeterminacy seriously.
All right, but shift them in what direction?
Well, I think one way we stop kidding ourselves that we have the real techniques of modeling that's going to deal with significant historical change. I think we need just to disabuse ourselves and our students of notions of that sort. And frankly, I think one of the best trainings that we can then give to students is a specific kind of historical instruction. I don't mean specific in the sense of focusing on one set or subset of historical phenomena, but specific in the way we look at history. And that is as a record of the surprises, the unanticipated turns, and the ironies in past events, and hence as a way of alerting ourselves and our students to the need for practical intelligence in coping with systems that oftentimes surprise us.
You told me before our taping, Bob Connor, that Thucydides, although he has the reputation as the founder, the father of historical studies, was very big on this notion of uncertainty.
Well, this is a radical view of my own. I'm not sure every Thucydidean scholar would accept it, Wayne. And certainly the conventional wisdom about him has been that here's somebody trying, along with a lot of other Greeks, to formulate rigorous laws about an essentially rational universe. And I think that there is that tendency, certainly, in Greek thought. It's a powerful and an important one. But when you look below the surface in Thucydides' narrative of the Peloponnesian War, what strikes me so powerfully is how often predictions go awry, how people think they've got a hold on it, they think they've outsmarted history, and what happens? It comes up against them and gets them precisely at the point where they're most confident. But understanding that involves with it alertness and peripheral vision, a sense of vision about the unexpectedness of history, that I think a lot of our work is concerned with, and I think it's one of the things that students take away from a proper liberal education. They take away it away after they've forgotten the specific dates and details, and when they have really got into their bones a sense of how historical processes work and how social change works.
What you're hinting at here is the possibility that we can train our young people to be not only knowledgeable about the past, but if not predictive, they can be wise or prudent about the future. That the upshot of a solid liberal education is wisdom. Doesn't that invite a lot of arrogance and pride?
Well, I think arrogance and pride, sure, but there's another vice in any good Greek scheme. Every vice has its opposite, and you've got to avoid them both. The other one is a excessive humility, a excessive avoidance of what the real implications of our material might be. And sometimes I think we've undersold it. We've failed to recognize that in a world of uncertainty, where the outcomes surprise you, this understanding of history, the understanding that comes from literature and art as well, as we look at the range of human responses and human experiences, mm-hmm. is just very important. And I think, if anything, we've undersold it.
What do you think's the next move here for the so-called interpretive class, the men and women who come to a center such as ours and spend not only hours but weeks and months writing books, figuring out what went on way back there and its relationship to the way we live today?
Well, I think there are a number of possible interpretive strategies. I detect in a lot of the humanists that we see here and a lot of the people certainly that are struggling with in questions of interpretation at the present time, a desire to get them linked once again into the forces that are shaping and changing our society so rapidly and so quickly. I don't think anybody's got the ideal strategy for that, but one necessary step, it seems to me, is that from time to time we talk about what the parallels are between what we're studying in the past and what we're studying, what we're seeing in our own society at the present time. That's at least one first step.
Robert Connor is the director of the National Humanities Center. The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond. Robert Connor's essay on politics and culture appears in the spring 1991 issue of The American Scholar. Soundings is available on cassette. Send $5 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code is 27709. Please ask for program number 551. That's program number 551. The address again is the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code 27709. When you write, please mention the call letters of this radio station. The National Humanities Center is eager to hear your comments about Soundings. Next week, conversations about multiculturalism and American schooling. Michael Valdez Moses of Duke University will discuss literature, the Third World, and American undergraduate education. Helena Gostillo of the University of Pittsburgh will discuss contemporary fiction by Russian women. Thanks for listening to Soundings. Until next week, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Major funding for Soundings comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities. Social Surprises, this week on Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Wolf Lepenies, director of the Institute for Advanced Study in Berlin, discusses political and cultural transformation in contemporary Eastern Europe. Robert Connor, director of the National Humanities Center, examines cultural analogies and the lessons of history. Political upheaval and social consequence, some answers and insights from the National Humanities Center, this week on Soundings.